Welcome to All Souls Forum. Next week at this time, All Souls Forum will be back from summer break. This week, though, we are going to do a special Radioactive Magazine one-hour feature, and we've got lots of great guests. First of all, Dr. Fred Whitehead is going to give a history of populism, going back to the Gilded Age, and show how that relates to what's going on in our environment, our political environment these days. We are also doing the encore presentations of some segments we're calling Community Voices, and we have three folks that are going to be doing Community Voices on this show this week. Peacework KC activist Ann Sullentrop, who has been working diligently on the issue of nuclear disarmament for a number of years now. Community Voices Bob Grove, who's of the Climate Coalition, talking about what the work they're doing to try and prevent the coming disaster of environmental degradation. And then our own Tom Crane, talking about the history of the Friends of Community Media. We also have an interview by Pastor Donna Simon of the St. Mark Hope and Peace Lutheran Church to talk about what it means to be a sanctuary congregation, and also an interview that I did during the homelessness marathon with Cheryl and William, who are two people that come around and do yard work for me and do odd jobs, but they have a very interesting history on what it's like to be homeless for these many years. So now, here's a special one-hour version of Radioactive Magazine. This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program. Okay, we're here with Dr. Fred Whitehead. He's a longtime friend of mine. Fred's a poet. He's a retired philosophy professor. He's active out in the community. He does a lot of speaking engagements. And I know one of his particular points of interest over years was populism, especially as it during the Gilded Age. So I was just curious to get his thoughts about the current use of the word populism, how it compares to what went on at the beginning of the 20th century, and maybe whether it's the same kind of thing or how it's different, and also kind of take a look at the use of populism around the world, which seems to have a very different meaning than it did from the populism we've talked about in the past. So I want to just turn over to you, Fred. Welcome to Radioactive Magazine.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Well, yeah, you mentioned the Gilded Age, which is a phrase often applied to the United States after the Civil War. You know, of course, we had the victory of the Union. We also had the victory of capitalism. And this led to the accumulation of tremendous wealth. At the same time, the country was being industrialized and transportation and the railroad system was expanding and so forth. So Mark Twain co-authored a novel called The Gilded Age. So it was an age of extreme poverty and wealth and polarization. At the same time, everything was expanding. So it was kind of a dramatic period. One thing that developed was the Grange movement, which was rural farmers' movement. And they got started right at the end of the Civil War. And they were kind of a curious organization because they had kind of Freemason aspects. They had a lodge and they had, you know, ranks within the lodge and rituals and songs and so forth, which helped build the solidarity of the movement. But it was really came about because of the low prices for commodities, for their grain, and corresponding high prices to get their grain to market. And the railroads were the way to do that. So, you know, they had no trucks or anything like that. So the railroads were the key. And they were active at the grassroots level and elected people to the legislature to try to regulate the railroads.
Because that the railroads pretty much had a stranglehold on moving their goods, right?
That's right. That was it. And that was, you know, any kind of long distance, the markets in New Orleans and back east were all at the mercy of the railroads. Another movement that developed was the Greenback Movement, which is kind of a curious movement because our currency was linked to the gold standard, and they wanted the, some of these people who were also Grange members sometimes wanted to have a new form of currency that was strictly paper-based, which was the greenback idea. So current currency questions got involved at the same time. What was the best basis for the money and so forth? A third organization that developed was the Knights of Labor, also founded immediately after the Civil War. And it was a large organization. It encompassed all kinds of trades and skilled labor and so forth, and unskilled. And they were active not only in the industrial centers, but out in the rural areas, so farmers could be members of the Knights of Labor. And the Knights of Labor did exist in the state of Kansas, for example, and there was a big strike in 1886 called the Great Southwest Strike, which the Knights of Labor got sort of dragged into, which was a defeat, but it was a very dramatic episode of labor-capital conflict at that period. So all of these things were kind of fermenting in the background. What happened in the late 1880s was a drought, particularly in this part of the country. And my grandfather lived through that drought and said it didn't rain for 10 years. So this, of course, afflicted the farmers' well-being and even survival. And at the same time, prices dropped. So the price was, instead of going up in the period of scarcity, it dropped. So between the drought and the collapse of grain prices, the farmers felt the need to organize, which they did as the Farmers Alliance, which again existed not only in Kansas, but all the way down into Georgia and so forth. So there was a Northern Alliance and a Southern Alliance. And they realized that they needed to get active politically and to take part in the legislative process, to get elected to the legislature, to get elected to the Congress. And one of the rather famous people of this movement at that time was a guy named Jerry Simpson of Medicine Lodge, Kansas, who lost all his cattle in a blizzard and was working as the city marshal of Medicine Lodge for $40 a month. He ran on the Union Labor Party ticket for Congress in 1886-88, and got almost no votes. But 1 year later, with the drought and the rise of the Alliance, he ran as an Alliance candidate for Congress in the big first district, the big Western Kansas district for Congress, and was elected. During the campaign, he was asked if farmers really burned corn for fuel in the summer of 1890, and he said yes. And by that light, they read the history of the Republican Party. So it was quite dramatic that he was went from obscurity to election to Congress. Another figure in Kansas during this period was a woman named Mary Elizabeth Lees of Wichita, Kansas, who was self-educated as an attorney. And she became a public speaker. And she gave these electrifying speeches in support of the farmers' movement, declaring, for example, that the vampire of monopoly fattens on the blood of the people. So that the rhetoric here was dramatic, and it fit the movement itself, which was aimed to take political power. This Farmers' Alliance led to the formation of the Populist Party, which had its national convention in Omaha in 1892. And this produced the Omaha Platform, which you can easily find on the internet. Had some dramatic elements. This was spelled out, I mean, it was sort of point by point, what we need, what the populist movement stood for. And one thing that they sued for was government ownership of railroads, telegraph, and telephone. Well, this was the first time in American history, really, that such a demand for government ownership had been advanced. And it called for other things, including limitation on immigration, I might say. But it was essentially a reform movement. They wanted dramatic change, but they did not exactly intend to overthrow capitalism, but rather to advance their own cause for a better deal and a more viable society. Well, this led to something in 1890 when the populists in Kansas ran for the state legislature. And in the 1892, resulted in a stalemate. The numbers between the Republicans and populists were evenly divided. So the question came up, well, how are we going to, who's going to be in charge? And this led in January of 1893 to the Great Legislative War, where everyone started bringing shotguns and rifles and stuff to Topeka. And there are many extant photographs of all these people on both sides lined up as if they were prepared to have something like the Russian Revolution. Well, this went on for a month or so. Actually, while some people were beaten up and so forth, no one was killed. And finally, they decided to sort of compromise, and the Republicans had control of the legislature in the House. It was this sort of thing that was happening that was, it affected the entire middle part of the United States and the part of the Southeast from Georgia to Minnesota. So it was, it's been called the largest Democratic mass movement in American history by Lawrence Goodwin, who wrote the sort of recently definitive book called Democratic Promise. So this movement by the mid-1890s was very dramatic. It looked like the farmers had a chance of taking political power. But what happened was, in the presidential election of 1896, William Jennings Bryan of Nebraska became the Democratic candidate, and he gave the famous Cross of Gold speech, in which he said, referring to the gold standard, "You shall not crucify mankind on the cross of gold." So he stood for silver currency, which is another kind of curious, if not bizarre, all these disputes about what was the basis of the currency. And they wanted silver because silver was produced in Colorado and in the West. And if it was the currency could be silver-based, then it wouldn't have to defer to the what they called the gold bugs back east and in Britain. Well, he gave the speech. he ran against William McKinley and was defeated. The controversy with the populace was there was a big split in the populace ranks. Some people thought, well, Bryan is the best we can do under the circumstances. Bryan did not even acknowledge the populist support. So in the election, what occurred was a tremendous support for Bryan in the farm states, very little support for Bryan from the industrial workers in the city. So there was a split between the farmers and the urban workers, which, of course, fractured the movement. And McKinley ran a deeply, quote-unquote, patriotic campaign. The entire country was blanketed with little American flags. He was the responsible, sober candidate compared to all these wild radicals such as Bryan. And when he won, there was a kind of trauma that ensued because the populace had actually supported him and had lost. So the air sort of went out of the populist movement after that time. Actually, there was some rain that returned, so that helped produce crops and so forth. Farmers' lot improved somewhat at that time. So anyway, there are many other aspects of this story, but that's some of the main elements of the classic American history of populism.
Okay, and you excuse my ignorance on world history, but is that the first time the word populism came into usage that you know of, or were there other populist movements?
Well, there have been other sort of dramatic, you know, there have been revolts and peasant revolts and so forth like that for hundreds of years, but in terms of active engagement in a political process, which involved elections, I think the 1892 was the first time that the word populist came about, certainly the first major use of it in the world. I might just mention one other thing. Everyone's seen The Wizard of Oz. There's a kind of allegory that some people contend is present in The Wizard of Oz in the novel, as well as in the film. If you remember, they're all trying to get to the Emerald City, Dorothy and so forth. And if you reflect, what's the problem with the Scarecrow? He doesn't have a brain. He represents the farmers. The Tin Woodman doesn't have a heart. He represents the industrial workers. The Cowardly Lion is supposedly William Jennings Bryan himself. And, of course, they want to go down the Yellow Brick Road, which represents the gold standard. And in the novel, Dorothy has silver shoes, which represents the silver standard, the magic silver standard. In the movie, they changed her slippers to ruby, but as you know. But in any case, there is, even in something kind of famous like The Wizard of Oz, it does have, some people contend, and this is controversial, that it has a populist element in the allegory.
Was the fact that it's set in Kansas? I mean, Kansas sounds like it played quite a role in the populist.
Yes, exactly. Movie. And so this was, like I say, this is a controversial interpretation,
sure.
And I won't get into all the ins and outs of whether it's true or not, but when I read the classic article that was published in the 1960s, I was really like the scales fell from my eyes. You know. But
When they use the word populism today, they talk about populism in Europe, but it's certainly a much different thing spiritually and class based. The whole, I mean, it doesn't seem to be the same thing at all, except for. Maybe unempowered people, you know, fighting against their perception of the empowered people. So compare what's going on now to historic populism that you're talking about.
Yeah, the conflict between a a mass movement of people and a moneyed elite is something that we do find in all the kinds of populism, or wherever they exist and wherever they've come developed around the world. There is a right-wing populism. And, for example, within the last several years, we had the Tea Party movement in America, which was partly created by the Koch brothers out of Wichita, Kansas. And they didn't do the whole thing, but they were supporting that. And what they did, they appropriated the language and imagery of revolt, the Tea Party, and so forth, in the cause of wealthy people.
Again in Kansas,
right?
Too.
Right. So it's. I think you get with the failure of a lot of the left wing movements, you get the rise of right wing movements that sort of take their place. And
Hegel or Marx, depending on who you want to point.
Yeah.
To,
well, somebody like Trump, who conceived of himself as a sort of populist, was a wealthy criminal. I mean, you know, the irony is how could all these poor people support somebody who's obviously has a criminal record and wealthy and all the rest of it? So it's one of these things where I think Engels had the notion of false consciousness. And that's what I think right-wing populism involves, is that it taps into supposed resistance and dislike and resentment of wealth and privilege, go drain the swamp in Washington and all that sort of thing. but it's actually it's fake. It's it.
That's why the culture wars, so to speak, is a good way of misdirecting. You know where their interests lie to these things that are tangential to their real welfare.
Right, and the you know the anti-abortion movement, which was a you know mass movement, certainly, and you know they had riots and you know violent demonstrations. A doctor in Kansas was assassinated by one of these people, and so that it has a mass element in it. And I might say I think there's a connection between fascism, as we understand it, and right-wing populism. They don't want to use the term for obvious reasons, but it's if you look at the way that they do it and the issues that they have, the racism, the nationalism, so forth, that's part of how it takes that form.
Yeah, and if I could think of names, I'd think of the guy that wrote the book of pointing out all the elements of fascism that's going on in some of these movements today.
Absolutely.
Well, Fred, we're out of time, but it was a good time had, and I really appreciate it was a very educational history of that period of time, and really thank you for being part of the Radioactive Magazine.
All right. Thanks much, Bill.
Community Voices is a production of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is our way of letting the voices of our neighbors be heard. Any opinions and views expressed are those of the speakers only and not necessarily those of Mid-Coast Radio Project, KKFI, board, staff, or volunteers.
Hi, this is Ann Solentrop, and I am a longtime nurse in the Kansas City area. I've been a pediatric nurse for about 45 years, and I work right now with mothers and babies after the baby's born. And I've been a anti-nuclear activist for about 10 years. It started when a good friend of mine, Donna Constantino, and I were having Easter brunch, and she had gotten burnt out working on a project concerning the Kansas City plant. And she asked me at brunch if I would take over for her. And I thought about it, and at the end of the brunch, I said, okay, but you better help me. And so for about a year there, she met with me every week and we worked on it. And what started it all was the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability, a nationwide network of 30 organizations whose members live near nuclear bomb sites, bomb production sites. They had came to Kansas City and alerted us that the Kansas City plant, well, number one, existed here, and that it was planning on building a new plant. And so we started organizing, and it took off. We had about, I'd say probably 100 members or so, and we were at all the protests and the city hearings on it, and we went out to the site, and when they were flattening the area to start construction, we held hands, 100 of us, and stopped the road graders or whatever you call them for about 2 hours. And so anyway, the little background for you, the Kansas City plant started in 1949, and it makes 85% of the parts for nuclear weapons. And it doesn't manufacture the plutonium and the uranium, but everything else that goes into a nuclear bomb it makes. And this entails a lot of toxins. And because of our activism, they finally fessed up that there was 2,400-ish toxins there. And these have been very, very detrimental to the health of the workers there. There's hundreds of them have come forward, and they were featured on a TV station, actually a whole series run by Russ Potosik of Channel 41. We have gone to the Memorial Day protest over the years at the plant. It's located at 150 Highway and Botts Road. It's right on the border between this is the new plant, between Kansas City and Grandview. And so PeaceWorks has held this memorial for the sick workers and the ones who have died. The last 10 years, there's been approximately 140 arrests out at the plant. And last year, I went to Germany to protest nuclear weapons that are being held through NATO sharing at Buchel in the southwest part of Germany. And there's 20 nuclear weapons, U.S. nuclear weapons that are there. Because of that, three visitors from Europe came to our protest on Memorial Day.
You've been listening to the voice of Ann Solentrop for Community Voices here on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Okay, I'm here with Pastor Donna Simon, and I'm going to let her. She was a recent guest on Radioactive Magazine, and her church has been involved with a lot of social activity, a lot of good causes around the community, so that's why she was on the show. But there are some new things going on with the church, so I'm going to let her remind you of the name of her church, where it's at, the kinds of things they support, and especially anything new that's going on. So welcome to Radioactive Magazine, Pastor Donna.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be back. The church is at the corner of Troost and Mannheim, or we say 38th and Troost, and has been there for 100 years. We did a little merger about 9 years ago and sort of tried to breathe a little more life into it, got involved in a lot more of the progressive things happening around town, most particularly the fight for 15 or the fight for living wage in America. And none of this is new to our church. We've been a welcoming church for almost 30 years. It's a very progressive, active church. But the thing that has happened in the last week is actually at the national level. And our National Evangelical Lutheran Church in America met last week in assembly and did several things, but only one of them made the front page of the Washington Post. And that was a resolution that actually came from the floor for the church to be a sanctuary denomination, which makes us, as far as we can tell, the first sanctuary denomination in the country. It came to the floor as a resolution from the Metro New York Synod, which said, we want to affirm the values of sanctuary, and we want the whole church to agree that we affirm the values of sanctuary. And of course, everyone said, yes, of course, yes, we're an immigrant church. Our church was settled by Swedes and Norwegians and other Lutherans in the country tend to be German, but we are the Scandinavian, very Northern European, whitest church in America. We did a lot of really nice things around race, finally, at this assembly as well. But the sanctuary resolution came from as an amendment on the floor. Someone said, well, you know, it's great to affirm the values of sanctuary, but why don't we declare ourselves to be a sanctuary body?
Okay, so I'm aware, of course, of sanctuary cities. Mm-hmm. So tell me what it means for a church to be a sanctuary church.
So we're still ironing out what it means for a denomination to say that it's a sanctuary denomination. We have five sanctuary synods. Synods are the regional bodies. So like our synod here is the state of Missouri, the state of Kansas. When you get into the Lutheran heartland, synods are smaller. The city of St. Paul, Minnesota is its own synod, because that's Lutheran Mecca up there. What it means for an individual congregation to be a sanctuary congregation is usually that you declare that you would be willing to provide physical sanctuary for someone who is being pursued on the basis of their, at this point, usually immigration status, although the word sanctuary has been variously applied. You know, in the 40s, it could have been applied to people who were providing sanctuary for Jews who were being hunted by Nazis. But in this case, in this country, we know that immigrants and refugees are literally being hunted by our government. And so as a church, what we have said is we don't think that's okay. And we especially cannot as a church support, condone, or even look the other way when children are being separated from their parents at the border, and when we know that people are being dragged out of their cars and dragged away from their workplaces. And now people who are in the country legally are being targeted by the administration. So it was a fairly timely resolution as well.
Absolutely. So what does it mean, I guess, effectively on how maybe you're going to be doing business over there? I mean, is there some way you're like going to get the word out, or tell
so,
me what your thoughts are on how to proceed from here?
So we, as a congregation, moved quickly. As soon as I heard, I heard from one of my members who said, "This is amazing." I said, "Great, you're the chair of the committee." So we started our sanctuary. We've had conversation in our congregation about sanctuary, but since we have a clear directive from the national church, we as a congregation will begin setting in place a whole set of recommendations for our congregation that will say these are the things that we commit to doing, including sheltering people who need shelter. We're waiting for we've got a set of talking points and we've got a set of legal directives, but we don't have a whole lot of clear guidance from the national office, and we're giving them a break. This happened last week, and and they were not prepared because no one thought it was going to come from the floor. But what it will mean, I think, for congregations is that they now have a national directive to be very clear in their communities that they support immigrants and refugees, including with their physical resources, with the resources of their buildings and their money and any advocacy that they can do, which is something that we certainly have already done here in Kansas City. I've been to immigration court a few times.
So, well, I've known for a long time that your church is, very progressive. Is that true of Lutherans in general, or are you like every other large institution, you have people on kind of both sides of the issue? And was it very controversial passing this at the convention?
We will lose churches. We already had four congregations in North Carolina begin the process of disaffiliating with the denomination. So it'll fall differently in different places and among different congregations. 10 years ago, interestingly, we were celebrating the 10th anniversary of the change in policy which allowed our denomination to ordain gay and lesbian persons in relationships. And after that move, we lost a lot of congregations. So we have become a more progressive denomination by attrition. So congregations that were starting, and a number of them had one foot out anyway.
Yeah.
You know, we have moved in that direction. It was very clear at this assembly that our denomination, and I think you're going to find this with a lot of mainline denominations, our denomination will not remain silent in the face of what's happening in this country. So we're becoming certainly more, not only more progressive, but more vocal.
Well, I've always known that you're congregation's been a courageous bunch. You've taken up the challenges of the rights and wrongs, and on the right side of the rights and wrongs from my perspective as
well.
Just
trying to be faithful.
There you go. Well, thank you so much, Pastor Donna. I appreciate it, and good luck with the upcoming efforts to put some meat on the bones of what it means to be a sanctuary congregation.
Thank you, Bill. I'll continue to keep you apprised. We're really excited about this.
Great. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Community Voices is a production of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is our way of letting the voices of our neighbors be heard. Any opinions and views expressed are those of the speakers only, and not necessarily those of Midcoast Radio Project, KKFI, board, staff, or volunteers.
This is Bob Grove. I'm a professional grassroots organizer here in Kansas City. Kansas City is my home. I've lived here my entire life, and we've seen a lot of changes. And, you know, it's a great neighborhood, and a lot of good things are happening, but we're facing a lot of challenges today. You know, the environment is so threatening, and we're seeing political action that's pulling us out of the Paris climate accord that's pulling us out of environmental treaties, reversing our own environmental laws, retracting our own Clean Water and Clean Air Acts, and basically threatening all of us. You know, global warming, a clean environment is a nonpartisan issue. It affects everybody, whether you're politically leaning to the right, to the left, whatever your religion, your gender, your nationality. We all suffer when natural disasters strike, and we all need to step up and do what it takes to help protect our environment. I'm part of a new group called the Climate Council of Greater Kansas City. We're a consortium of local environmental groups whose purpose is to amplify the voices of existing environmentalists. We've got a lot of great environmental groups working on the ground in the greater metro area, but a lot of them are kind of siloed. You know, we don't know that they're there, they don't know each other's there. So we're working to bring all of those people together and share resources to make a meaningful effort to reverse global warming. We've got a lot of good programs. I'd encourage you to take a look at the website, climatecouncilgkc.org. We produce a climate digest every week. It's just a short email that tells you about upcoming environmental events in the metro area. It contains some links to articles that are important on environmental issues. And it shows you what the various environmental groups in town are doing to make a difference and how you can become part of that, how you can make a difference. We offer educational program to look at things that you can change in your homes or the way you travel or the way you eat that can also help global warming, help reverse it. And most importantly, we show you how to get engaged with the community and work to unify our efforts to make the most meaningful changes we can. If you're already an environmentalist or if you're working to reverse global warming, if you have a group or you have an idea for a group, we encourage you to come partner with us. We have both nonprofit partners and for-profit allies. Our goal is to amplify your voice and make you more effective in making the kind of environmental global warming changes that we see needed in the upcoming few years. This is Bob Grove for Community Voices on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Okay, I've got two guests here with me. I'm going to let them introduce themselves. Just give me your name, just first names if you want.
I'm Cheryl.
And I'm Williams.
Okay. And I know these guys because they have been they've been doing a lot of handyman work for me, or handywoman work, if it's the case may be. And so I'm going to let you guys tell your story, how long you've been together, how you started doing the kind of work you did. But mainly I want you to tell me as you go along your different living situations of when you had a place to stay, when you were homeless, the kind of challenges you have, and whatever, and I'll just ask some questions along the way. So who's going to be the first spokesperson
here? I guess I will.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
Well, we originally met in Arkansas while I was traveling on business, and we became friends. And then I was settled into Kansas City, and I got a job at the Holiday Inn Express on Westport Road. Got a little apartment over on Locust. He came up. After he arrived here, I got hit by an uninsured drunk driver head-on. And had a lot of medical problems, almost lost a kidney, lost my job, inevitably ended up losing my apartment. So we were out on bicycles trying to do handyman type work, mowing lawns in the summer and raking leaves and shoveling snow in the winter, cleaning gutters, doing some kind of housekeeping if I could get the work.
Just wherever you can scrounge up somebody to pay you a few bucks.
Yes.
How did you find people to...
We just went knocking on doors.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. I guess from that point on...
So you were on bicycles, but you ended up losing your apartment, right?
No, we didn't have an apartment.
Okay.
We lost the apartment.
I'm getting ahead of the story.
Lost the apartment. We had already purchased a car. Just... off the, you know, like garage sale or yard sales kind of things, we managed to come across a couple of bicycles. So he got those running for us, William did, and so we were pulling a ladder, which someone had given us, behind one bike, and a lawnmower behind the other bike, and just riding around all over, trying to just going and knocking on doors and trying to find work. We did save up enough to get a little car, or actually a big car, but the radiator leaked. By now it's about winter time, and there's huge snowstorms coming. So one of our clients that had let us do some painting on their house over on Paseo, let us park our car in the alley back behind their house and live in it. So we did that.
But so you're living in the wintertime?
In the wintertime, in the car, in the snow. And since the radiator leaked, we had to carry jugs of water with us. We couldn't run the car without getting out in the snow, putting water in the radiator, turning the car on, running the heater until it warmed up, until the car started overheating, and then we would have to turn it off.
And paying for gas on top
exactly.
of that.
Exactly. Yeah. And then when it got, you know, like 2 or 3 hours later when we were freezing to death again, we had to do the whole thing over, all over again.
So how long did you live in the car?
Oh, gosh. That time, probably 4 or 5 months.
Okay, so through most of winter.
All through the winter, yeah. Through the winter. It was probably January, February, we finally got a little apartment over on near St. Peter's.
Okay.
Or not St. Peter's, St. Paul's.
Over that apartment,
okay. It's obvious.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Oh, stayed in
we
the shed?
Stayed, just a little storage shed. Behind this lady's house on, where did she live? On Harrison.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. She was redoing her cabinets in the kitchen and redoing her hardwood floors in the house in preparation to sell the house because she was moving to North Carolina. So she let us live in her shed, and she put us a little air mattress back there and a heater and a porta potty.
I was going to ask about that, but go ahead. Okay.
And she paid us $7.50 an hour a piece and provided that and 2 meals a day.
To do what?
To do in the work.
Okay.
We were redoing her cabinetry and redoing her hardwood floors and some other odd things around the house, fixing some of the walls and stuff. So we did that for 3 or 4 months.
Yep,
and then at the same time, when we weren't working in her house for her, we had some free time. We would go out and try to find other work as well. And saved up enough money, we got a little apartment.
Obviously living pretty hand to mouth here.
Yes.
How hard was it to find an apartment you could afford?
Oh.
How long did you look?
We had to stick with the utility paid ones because we never knew what our budget was going to be. With utilities. So, and we just had, we actually, as it turned out, we couldn't keep up the payments on the apartment. We lived there for almost a year, I think.
Yeah.
And then.
Did you get any subsidy for it?
Or? No subsidies.
Okay, go ahead.
This one was, about $450 or $500 a month, but there was utilities paid. It was a studio.
Yeah.
It didn't have a bedroom, separate bedroom, or anything. Everything was in one big room.
Right.
And we had a little kitchen off to the side.
When we had stayed on Brown Vines,
when
we had a helicopter.
Yeah, one of the times when we were living in the car,
we had to put up
a gentleman let us park on his little pad.
Yeah, a little pad.
It was on a corner, but it was right next to his house. He had put in a pad. I think he used to have like an RV or something that he parked there, but he had moved out and was trying to rent the place. But he let us park our car there, and all of a sudden one night, we're just about asleep, and this big spotlight shines down through our windshield, and then we hear a knocking on the, we had plastic bags over the windows in the back, so that we could,
get a little bit of privacy.
And the next thing we know, the police are knocking on our doors and telling us to keep our hands where they can see them and all this.
Yeah.
And we had to convince the officers that we did have permission to stay there, and we had the gentleman's phone number.
Right.
But it was like 1 o'clock in the morning,
Man, it was shocking.
And I said, you're welcome to call him if you want to and confirm this. So they didn't. They let us go, and they said, somebody called it in, so they had to come and check it out.
Right.
So that was one of our little dramas that we had to go through. But eventually, we ended up in this little apartment, but winter came, and we couldn't find enough work to keep it up. So here it is, winter again, and we're out. At least we had a vehicle this time.
So where'd you park this vehicle this time?
Well, this time, one of our clients had a rental house in Independence.
Right.
He needed some work done. The renters had just moved out. They'd been there for 18 years. No maintenance or painting had been done in these 18 years. So he wanted us to go in and clean it up. Repaint it, the whole inside of it. And we scrounged us up a little mattress. And the first weekend that we were there, the electricity was shut off. And it's the dead of winter. Another big 4 feet of snow. And we're in there just huddling up, trying to stay warm. He had not paid the bill because he didn't worry about it until we moved in. And then he didn't know it was going to be disconnected. So anyway, we went through the whole weekend with no electricity and no heat. And then finally he got the bill paid and they turned it back on. And we worked and stayed there for a while.
And I was the only one there. I just kept up with some vehicles that were cheap.
Yeah, he was always, he has a talent for finding vehicles.
Okay. I found them sitting them in the yards and everything. And
well, sometimes the cheaper cars are the most expensive in the long run, you know, but keep them running. But,
we ran across
are you
that
pretty
a
good,
few times.
Were you a pretty good mechanic?
Yeah.
Okay.
I catch them when they're not running, they're sitting up in the garage and got ribs all over and everything. And that people let me have them real cheap.
I know. I've seen you with two or three vehicles since I've known you, and with the bicycles in between.
When one breaks down, we'll go back to the bikes again.
Yeah, we got the bike. We keep bikes up.
We had this sort of situation up and down, and never could, you know. Finally, in the spring and summer and fall, we could save and get into an apartment. But then when winter came, we couldn't keep up the payments. I ended up moved into an apartment. I'm not going to say the name over on 39th.
Oh, yeah.
Near Maine, between Maine and Broadway there.
Uh-huh.
We moved in there into a studio.
Oh, yeah.
And we're able to keep it up, and we had a good relationship with the manager.
Right.
The with the owner. The manager at the time had a medical problem, let's say, and so he had to be gone for several months. And so she asked me to manage the apartments for her. So I did that for about 6 months, and then he came back, and I had the apartment at that point came with the job, and I got very little salary. Yeah, and I wasn't paid by the hour either. And people were locking themselves out of their apartments at 4 o'clock in the morning. And so that was a nightmare. But anyway, we ended up losing that apartment because I couldn't find a job quickly enough after the other manager came back, and she promised him his job, so I was out. And then we ended up back in a car again, and at least it wasn't as cold this winter. But back and forth and back and forth, and we stayed in shelters a few nights.
Yeah, tell me about the shelters. Is it hard to find?
It's hard to get in.
And then if you got in there, you had to be back in there before dark.
Yeah, at 4 o'clock or 4:30 in the evening. Yeah.
So if you're scrounging to find work
to
do.
Yeah, we're trying to find work, and the weather's good. People don't get home from work until 5:30.
Right.
And we're out knocking on doors until 7 o'clock, and if you wanted to stay in a shelter, you had to be there by 4:30. That kind of defeated the purpose of us trying to save any money. We couldn't make any money if we had to give up all of our working hours.
Sure.
So we ended up just finding places to sleep.
Yeah.
But most of the time, we did have some type of a little car.
Uh-huh.
So we would just pull over and park on the side of the road, or, we had friends who let us park in front of their house or something.
Well, we could have been rich also, wealthy rather, but we had stayed in motels.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think the last time, before I'm bringing you up to date, to current time a little bit, but you were in motel not too long ago, right?
Yes.
How in the world can you afford to stay in a motel?
That's tough. $50+ a night.
Right.
We tried to work enough to we could make enough for a week.
We worked hard.
And we stayed over on Prospect in a motel there, and we basically lived in motels. And when we could get the work.
Yeah, I'm just thinking.
We were out begging for money.
Knocking for work.
People and good clients like yourself were loaning us money, toward future work.
I'm thinking, when you don't have a house and you want to move into it, even if it's a very cheap rent, you still got to come up with
deposits
and sometimes last month's rent and all that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
It's pretty tough to get that kind of money together, isn't it?
It really is.
We bounced up and down and back and forth.
So you were at a motel then, maybe a year ago?
We were in a motel a couple of years ago, and then we moved into a high rise over here on 63rd.
Yeah,
but the conditions there were so terrible they turned on the heat and they turned on the air. They turned on the heat at the end of September. And they had so much bacteria and mold in their ductwork that within a week after the heat was turned on, he would be in the hospital because he has COPD and several other health problems.
So you've had you've had the health problems from the wreck, and you've had the COPD, and
right.
I know you've been talking about trying to afford the medications and everything else that goes with that.
Yeah. Well, at some point along the way here, let me see. I think it's probably been like 2014. So it's been about 5 years now. He finally did get his disability approved.
Okay. This and Social Security or SSI? Or?
It's SSI. It's disability.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
And we were able to move into this high rise once we got that. And then the conditions were so bad with it, you know, affecting his health so terribly that we finally got another little apartment just within a few blocks. It was Thanksgiving weekend. We were due to move in. We get that big ice storm just this past Thanksgiving. And the pipes burst in the apartment and flooded it, and this in the building that our apartment was in. So we couldn't move in, and we had our deposit money and our rent money all saved up, and we ended up having to spend it on motels. They got the apartment going, but by that point, we didn't have enough money to move in. So here we are back in the motel again until March, when we could save up enough money to get a little rental house, and we love it.
That's tell me about the rental house. I've been by there. I've been inside. It's a great house.
Yes.
Is it? Well, I don't. You
it's
have
a
to,
little.
You don't
bedroom.
Have to give me numbers, but
no, that's okay.
You make it
we
enough.
We pay $500 a month.
Okay.
And we pay our own utilities. And the landlord is the sweetest lady you could ever meet. She said she keeps the rent fairly low because she wants people to be able to stay in the house.
Bless her.
That
heart.
Way, she doesn't have such a high turnover of renters.
Yeah.
And she was great to work with us. You know, she let us pay our deposit out over a couple of months. And so it has just been a godsend. We have been so blessed with this situation we're in now. I have my own little garden in the back.
Yeah.
And we fixed it up inside the way we wanted. We've got our own privacy. We don't have to worry about mold or bacteria. We have window air conditioners.
And you have a pretty good sized backyard, too.
Yeah, the backyard is huge. And we have part of our, you know, work we do is mowing lawns. So we have plenty of lawnmowers. We take care of our own yard.
Yeah, we've been in the yard sale, too.
And, yeah, we just had a yard sale, and we'll be having another one because not very much stuff sold.
So. Yeah, okay. I'm going to say this to the wrong. There's nothing unusual that's being said about that apartment over there at Woodland. I hate to say it.
In Woodland, yeah.
But there have been complaints to the
people are dropping
TV stations. So therefore, I don't feel bad saying nothing about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been on
they
TV.
They had dead bugs over there. I mean, they had, look at elevators that doesn't work.
And it's nine-story building.
Then seven stories up. You got to walk down, but my breathing problem is it was difficult.
And then walking back up.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, yeah. Serious. It was terrible.
The fire department has been called there many times.
Well, people.
That's all I say. I wouldn't advise anybody to go there.
Well, we're on the air, so I don't know if we want to really say the name.
That's all right. It's fine. We got the part of town. Well, anyway.
He has bent it anyway. Yeah, it's a 63rd and Woodland.
Okay, fair enough. That's good.
Like I said, there ain't nothing that I haven't seen. I mean,
No. There's people. We see the renters we knew from there at the grocery store and at the dollar store and stuff now, even since we've moved out. And this was this past Thanksgiving when we moved out.
And people are dying.
People are dying right and left. Now, grant you, there are a lot of elderly and for the elderly and the disabled. So you have to take that into account. But perfectly healthy people, for the most part, that are just up and up there in years, and they're dying because of the mold.
Wow.
They are.
They find people dead in their apartments. And it is sad.
It is
sad. And because it is a subsidized property, the health department can't do anything about it. Well, apparently, that's what we're told.
Yeah, they don't even investigate going on.
But we got away from there.
We're in good shape, though. So far, we've been pulling up, and I've been continuing finding vehicles. So that we can carry on and get off the bus.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've been through a lot of trials and tribulations, but like I said, we've been blessed a lot along the way because at least we weren't sleeping on a park bench.
Right.
There have been a lot of people that taken pictures of me on that bicycle with that ladder. they had me to pose for them.
We'll be riding down the street.
Riding down the street taking pictures.
People be out by their cars just with their phones filming him.
Yeah, they would.
Well, Cheryl and Will, I really appreciate it. You know, I've known you guys for a long time.
You have several years.
But I didn't know all the story. It's very
well, and you have been a lot. You and Judy, your wife, have helped us out a lot. Well, we were talking about the good clients that would give us money in advance. You are one that did that very often.
Well,
matter of fact, I think we still owe you a few dollars.
Well, we're not going to worry about that for a while.
Okay. But, I remember, though, when I first met you, though, when you was stuck out there.
It's okay.
I remember when you stuck out there in the snow. That's when I first met you. I came up the Shelby to get you out the house.
You did. I remember that now.
That's the first time. And I mean, from then on, you've been great.
My best friend and one who was one of our good clients to begin with, we met her because she left her keys in her front door. Yeah. And I went knocking on her door for work. And the keys were in the knob on the door. And I took them. Nobody answered. So I took the keys out and took them next door. There was a single lady living there also, and I asked her if she knew her neighbor and told her what had happened, and she said, oh, yeah, I'll make sure she gets him. Well, from that point on, she says she didn't have any trouble trusting us. Because, I mean, we could have walked in and taken her for everything she had.
Yeah, okay.
But, no, we just gave her keys to the neighbor. And But, yeah, we've met a lot of clients just doing good for them.
Good, too. Good deal.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Community Voices is a production of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is our way of letting the voices of our neighbors be heard. Any opinions and views expressed are those of the speakers only and not necessarily those of Mid-Coast Radio Project, KKFI, board, staff, or volunteers.
Hi, I'm Tom Crane. I'm with a group called Friends of Community Media, which was founded over 10 years ago with the merger of two groups, Citizens for Media Reform and the Friends of Community Radio. And Friends of Community Media is a 501c3 not-for-profit group, and it's set up to preserve and foster citizen participation in the media. We also try to assist diverse groups and citizens to create their own media, influence existing media, and promote diverse media ownership. And through the years, we've had several events that have, for the purpose of educating the people on how important the media are in American life, and why we should understand how the media shape what we believe. And sometimes it doesn't work the way it should. But we've set up years ago in 2011 Grassroots Radio Conference, which brought in people from all over the United States, from other community radio stations besides KKFI. We also have given out progressive media awards to people who have had outstanding service, media spokespeople from around the country. And we also have had a media education week where every day we had different workshops that would let people know about how they could participate in the media and what to look for when and look critically at the media. And we also have a monthly meeting of our members and board people. One of the concerns we have is the consolidation of so few corporations that own most of the media in the United States, and the idea that ordinary citizens cannot participate in the media that that gives them information. Now, a good example of this would be Sinclair Broadcasting, which owns a number of stations around the country and kind of gives a party line of what they're all supposed to say at the same time. And it's reminiscent of a totalitarian state that brings forth what they believe to be true and wants to get people to believe the same things. We also have seen throughout the years some media outlets serving as propaganda factories for certain people or ideologies. And we believe that many voices should be heard throughout the country, not just a few that with the money. So part of what we've done is to support community organizations and media groups like KKFI, which is a media outlet, which is like no other, and provides services and voices to people in throughout America, America as it is, not as one monocultural nationalist type of media block. Unfortunately, a lot of the media that we are exposed to give us a one-sided view, and often that is shaped through their advertisers. They don't want to offend their advertisers. So what we would like to do is encourage not-for-profit media groups to start forming and take care that citizens can participate in their own media. For those that are interested in how they can shape the media and get involved with learning about the media, you can contact us on our website at ourfcm.org. That's ourfcm.org, and you can find out information about our organization there, or you can email us at savethemedia@cs.com. That's savethemedia@cs.com. And this is Tom Crane for Community Voices on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Thank you for joining us on this special edition of Radioactive Magazine. Now stay tuned for a local showcase.